We are going to start. We don't have a quorum, so we can't pass the minutes, but we'll get you started. We have five Republicans, and I'm sure Representative Carlson can match our wits, and you probably don't need any help over there, so we could get started.
Well, I was just thinking we could add up the number of terms on your site there and see if
you match my terms.
Probably not. I could give you a chase, but it wouldn't get there.
I started my 40th term. I mean, 40th year. Not 40th term. That would be really 40th year. This.
Well, if it was your 40th term, I would be calling someone to see if there was any legality there. Your mind probably, well, your mind might still be with us, but might not be working to capacity. All right, go ahead and get started, and when we get a quorum, we'll do the minutes and all that kind of stuff. And introduce yourself for the tape.
Chairman, committee members, thank you for inviting us to speak to you today. My name is Gay Grider. I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator, and I have my colleague with me, Kristen Hansen, who's our Assistant Commissioner for Treasury and Debt Management, and we will be speaking to you today. I will go first. I'm going to give you an overview on the capital budget process, some of the constitutional and statutory limitations on use of bonding proceeds, and then my colleague will take over and give a general discussion about bonding in our state context and also our capital investment guidelines. And we'll be happy to take questions either during our presentation and afterwards. Our capital budget process, which is both statutory and administrative as it's developed over the years, is for management and budget to create a standardized description of state agency and local government projects and their costs, both capital and any potential operating impacts on the state, to facilitate our analysis and also your decision making. We collect, and I'll describe this in more detail later on, and present this information, which is necessary for the legislature to evaluate and select capital projects for enactment in the bonding bill. The typical capital budget process is that our statutes, and this is in Chapter 16A, presume that major capital budgets will be presented by the governor for consideration by the legislature in even-numbered legislative sessions. So that would include this session. Now, capital budgets are also typically considered, usually to have small...
Excuse me, could we... you're going to have to pull that microphone a little bit closer or lean into it. It's not picking you up
all right.
as well as it should. And then which... of the handouts you gave us, are you working? Are they the same as what you have up?
Yes.
Which one is it? Because I'm not finding that.
The
page.
Capital budget process.
Whatever.
We have one titled State Debt Management Practices. And then what is a bond? And then we have. Looks mostly like information and forecasts.
Because we sent three over.
Did we send?
Mm-hmm. We sent two. We got two.
Chairman, I had thought I sent that over. If we didn't send that over, I can absolutely send that to Tom after the meeting so that everyone can have hard copies and you can post
why don't
it on
we?
The
why don't we
website.
Do that? Why don't you send it over
absolutely.
Again, and then we'll distribute that tomorrow, and we'll have to pay attention and look at the screen, which I can't see from here, but that's okay.
You want to switch, Mr. Chairman?
No.
I do apologize for that.
That's fine.
As I said, capital budgets are typically presented in large capital budgets are by statute presented by the governor to the legislature initially in January at the beginning of even year sessions. However, capital budgets are also considered on an informal basis in odd numbered years, and those bonding bills can be quite large, such as the one that was enacted last session, special session in July, was for $500 million. The capital budget process is guided by the state constitution and by state statutes. And I'm just going to touch on these quickly here because I will explain them in more detail in this presentation. Article 11, Section 5 of the state constitution governs our state bonding, and my colleague will discuss some of those sections later, but primarily we issue under Section 7, Article 5, which is general obligation bonding. Some of the state statutes that come to bear are Section 16A.11, presentation of preliminary and final capital budgets to the legislature, Section 16A.86, the requirements for the legislature to appropriate capital project grants to political subdivisions of the state, and Section 16A.502, non-state commitments to capital projects to supplement the state funding. Since most of our bonding projects are funded under Article 11, Section 5A of the Constitution, that subsection imposes these four requirements: that the project be publicly owned, that means by the state or by one of its political subdivisions, such as a county, city, or other municipality. The expenditures must be capital in nature, related to land, buildings, or building improvements. They can't be operations and maintenance. They can't be personal property. There must be a public purpose for the project, and the project or program must be clearly set forth in the law. Statutory requirements. This is a more specific discussion of those statutes I mentioned earlier. Section 16A.11 requires two submissions of the capital budget to the legislature for consideration in the even-numbered years. July 15th of last year was our deadline for presenting the preliminary requests from both state agencies and local governments to the legislature. We got that over to you on August 19th because of the shutdown. Capital projects and programs must indicate both, by statute, must indicate both local governments and state agencies' contemplated requests for this project, not only for the current biennium, but their planned requests in future biennia in order to complete the project over a total of 6 years, three biennia, to allow legislators some understanding of what approving this portion of the project would entail for future budgets. The governor's budget, which he submitted on January 17th of this year, because January 15th was on a Saturday, shows both his recommendations and also all the entire universe of the requests that we received. The binders that we sent over with the governor's request show agencies' priorities for their projects. They're not the governor's priorities. They're not statewide priorities. They're just individual agencies' priorities. And also, for local governments that are submitting more than one project, their internal priorities for their projects. Section 16A.502, non-state commitments to capital projects. That requires that MMB and the agencies that are administering local government projects be able to understand that full project costs must be available before starting the project. So the onus is on the local government to show that it has all funding in hand before the state money is disbursed. Of course, that's just good fiscal policy to make sure that the state money is not going to construct the beginning of a project that subsequently cannot be funded to completion. Section 16A.86 imposes more requirements when the state appropriates grants to local governments. MMB receives those requests, some of them, and sends them on to the legislature. The local governments are also free to ask their legislatures to sponsor capital budget bills during session. So there's two ways those can come in. This statute provides that there is a presumption that a 50% match will be required of local governments, but that's certainly something that the legislature can do away with, and it certainly has done in the past. Sometimes it even requires more than a 50% match, or it can require less or none at all. Requests through MMB must state the public purpose that will be served, whether the project will require new or additional state operating subsidies, so that both we and legislators can understand if the project will have operating impacts as well as capital impacts. whether the requesting entity has passed a resolution in support of the project, and whether pre-design submission has already been made to the Department of Administration. This chart explains in simplified form the basic timeline for capital budget preparation, submission, and consideration in an even, again, in an even year session, such as we're in the middle of now. Our process started back in April of last year when we issued instructions for both agencies and local governments to submit their requests, and we have standard format. They vary for local governments and for agencies, but we do, as I mentioned, we like having a standard format. It makes it much easier to compare requests. In May of 2011, agencies began submitting preliminary project information to us. June 25th is the statutory deadline for agencies to submit preliminary requests, and it's the requested date for state, for local governments to get their requests in. They don't have a statutory deadline. As I mentioned, we made our preliminary submission on August 23 of all the requests that had come through MMB to date. This doesn't include any governor's recommendations. On December the 1st, we issued our state budget forecast and our debt capacity forecast. On January 17th, as I mentioned, the governor presented his recommendation for his capital projects that he would like to see funded in bonding legislation to the legislature. In late February of 2012, you can expect MMB to update our budget and debt capacity forecast. And then, of course, as we go through session, you'll hear bonding bills being considered and heard and moving through conference, and perhaps a bond will be
enacted. Excuse me, Ms. Ryder. We do now have copies of that.
Oh, you do?
It's being passed out to members so we can follow along.
Excellent.
And since we have a quorum, the chair will move the minutes, and if you notice on the minutes, right after no members were excused, it says Representative Jeffrey Hayden was absent. He's a senator, so we will, with your approval, well, we could leave him absent. No, I would move that we strike that sentence, and then I think the minutes would be okay. Representative Scalzi.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move those minutes, except that I think I was there because I remember seeing the Jeffrey Hayden thing right next to me, and I don't see my name on there, so I would make that correction.
Representative Scalzi, are you in the Senate, too?
Wait, is that a Senate?
No.
Not yet.
Ooh, is that a sign? All right, well, we will add Representative Scalzi. Any other corrections that anyone sees? With those corrections, all those in favor of those corrections, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That carries, and then I will move the amendments, the minutes as amended. Any discussion? Seeing none. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes carry. Now you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The off-year capital budget process, probably the most important thing that can be said about that, because it happens differently every time, is that there's not a statutory or administrative process whereby an off-year budget occurs. MMB does not have any process, nor are we required by statute, to formally solicit requests from agencies and local governments as we do for even-numbered sessions. Typically, what starts this off is if, for example, the governor recommends or he or she would like to present a budget, or if there's emergencies that have happened that impose a necessity for funding before the next even year session. And in fact, typically off-year bonding bills are more of the emergency type nature. In the past, or at least this past year, Governor Dayton was interested in having a bonding bill. He felt that it was important given the job climate and low interest rates. So he solicited agencies to come and speak to him and talk to him about bonding projects. And at that point, we as an agency tried to find out as much as we could about the different requests that were being submitted to him and those that he might be interested in. MMB has an ongoing role after the bonding bill is enacted in many ways. We make sure that agencies set up the project appropriations in the state accounting system. We review documentation submitted by grant recipients to show that any local match required in riders or other special conditions required by law has been met. We assist agencies in determining whether full project funding has been met as required by statute. On an ongoing basis, we train agencies, we work with local governments, we have capital grant manuals and other printed matter which we make available to agencies and local government grantees on an ongoing basis to make sure that they understand both the statutory requirements that come with this source of funding and also that they understand both the state statutory and the regulations that the IRS presents relating to tax-exempt bonding proceeds and the restrictions on that use, and of which is becoming more important in recent years. We monitor what's called private use in bond finance facilities, whether they're owned by the state or by local government. This year I've devoted an entire slide to the private use issue because this is something that's coming up more and more as we've seen over the past couple of decades as the legislature has become more willing to fund projects that do not have, for example, a traditional public use or, for example, buildings that are occupied by state agencies or school buildings, higher education buildings, prisons, things that are clearly occupied by government and used for a clear government purpose. We're seeing more and more appropriations that are being used for arts, cultural centers, sports facilities, business incubators, and the like. The concern is not that these are not very worthy projects. The concern is that they create or can give rise to use by entities other than the public owner of those facilities. Even nonprofits are an issue, whether it's nonprofits or private for-profit entities that are using these facilities for a private use. They're making money on the use of those facilities. The facilities and projects where we see this occur often are stadiums, arenas, and other sports facilities, convention centers, and business incubators. You can imagine all of these have potential for private use, including naming rights, rented skyboxes in sports facilities, concessions, broadcast rights, advertising, sponsorships, and leased space. And this seems to come up more and more as local governments and nonprofits who have tight budgets just like we do are looking for alternative and innovative sources of funding. The concern is that because we in the past have issued tax-exempt bonding for 99% of our capital budget appropriations, is that the IRS very strictly or greatly restricts the amount of these facilities. It's a tiny percentage that can be used for private use. And the IRS allows a small amount of that because they realize it's almost impossible to not have some. But, and my colleague will speak more to this in a minute, in this environment of much greater IRS supervision and auditing of tax-exempt issuers, such as the state, we're becoming very, very concerned about this issue. And in Governor Dayton's bonding bill, we even inserted a provision in the normal section that authorizes management and budget to issue bonds to state that we will always issue tax-exempt bonds except where we're concerned that the private use may require them to be issued on a taxable basis.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, did you want to take questions, or because I had a question.
Was that a question?
Well, that was my first question. Are you taking questions?
Sure. Go ahead.
When that one section there with the examples of things like naming rights, rented skyboxes, and so on, when we're down the road already, I'm thinking of the University of Minnesota and the naming rights for the TCF Stadium in exchange for, I think it was something like $30 million that they paid for the naming rights, and then the Target Center as well. And then these are some of the issues that are surfacing with the conversations about the Viking stadium. But my question right now is, we're already down the road with naming rights with the U of M stadium and with Target Center. So what happens now there?
Ms. Ryder.
Or what could happen in retrospect, being that we've already done that and accepted the money and...
Chairman.
Ms. Ryder.
Representative, what we have done in the past is where we're aware of these issues, we try to work within IRS regulations in terms of there's very complicated regulations under the tax code that allow... the private use to be allocated to the different funding sources to a project. So when private use is a problem, you basically consider all of the different funding sources. Local governments have more statutory authority to issue different kinds of bonds than the state does. They have the ability to issue certain kinds of bonds where private use can occur, and we do not have that ability, except we were given a very low percentage allowance for private use. And in some instances, for example, in the Duluth Entertainment Center, we did do that kind of allocation. We got the city of Duluth to agree to accept that private use to their bonds rather than it relating to the state's bonds. We're able to take a small amount of use, and at times I know that we have agreed to take that private use. It's something that we're very careful to monitor, and we're trying now to address these issues before we issue the bonds rather than trying to work within regulations to solve the problem after the bonds are issued.
Representative Carl.
Chairman, I'll stop there other than I was on the conference committee when we authorized the construction of the stadium at the University of Minnesota, and we were very aware that TCF was going to put in a large sum of money. Like I said earlier, my recollection was $30 million for the naming rights, and that was a key part of the financing. I thought it was built with state bonds, unless the university issued their own bonds. Is that what happened? Okay. So long ago, I'd forgotten that. So that must be the loophole then, where they were able to do it.
Go ahead.
Chairman, Representative, I was not working at the state at the time, but the University of Minnesota did issue those bonds, and we can verify because some of those bonds may have been issued as taxable by the U.
Okay. It's always helpful, Mr. Chairman, to have your memory corrected or whatever.
Well, especially Representative Carlson, when it's as long as your memory is. Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's the same question. So what about Excel, Target? What's the reason for each of them? And then, in addition to that, if I read the rest of this slide here, it says examples of facilities where private use may occur: stadiums, convention centers, business incubators. I mean, have you made an exception in each one of them? Has MMB made an exception in each one of them? And if so, I guess this is the first time I've really heard it too. Mm-hmm. And it's big. Excel, Target.
Chairman and Representative, these are good questions, and all of those projects preceded both my and my colleagues' tenure at the state. That's something I can't speak to how those were handled.
Well, Mr. Chair.
What about Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, the Excel Center was a general fund appropriation to the city. Well, it's a loan. It was an appropriation, but $17 million was forgiven of the $65 million appropriation in 1998. The remaining $48 million is a loan that the city has to repay to the state and has been repaying. I think right now it's at about $2 million a year for repayment. Things like the Metrodome that you asked about, first of all, those bonds were issued back in 1992 before some of the federal regulations had changed relating to private use, but also those bonds are long gone. They were also issued by the Metropolitan Council, not by the state.
Actually, I was thinking Target. Mr. Chair.
Well, Target Center, those are Minneapolis City bonds. They're not state bonds.
Okay, and then just proactively, now that you are there, stadium, convention, you know, we've had numerous proposals this year, but definitely convention, I mean, definitely stadium.
That's exactly right. There's four or five different projects just in the governor's bonding bill alone that we're concerned would have to be issued on a taxable basis just because of private use concerns.
And then, Mr.
Representative Clark.
I know there's a discussion in the whole housing arena as well with appropriation bonds.
Ms. Hansen, you want to take that one?
Chairman House, Representative, the issue with the appropriation bonds came up during the special session with the tobacco securitization bonds, where this goes back to that letter that was written in the Senate by the AG's office in 2009 questioning the legality of using appropriation bonds for tobacco bonds. And so there's kind of a question of legality there that has surfaced because of that. And a number of the bonds that are issued by the state do require the AG to issue sign off on them. So
Representative Clark.
So the stadium that's being proposed?
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Representative, at this point in time, we have not seen a proposal, and it's going to depend a lot on the use agreement and the lease agreement that the team has with the state, and we have not vetted any tax issues with anybody at this point in time, but we'll obviously do so.
To be determined, I guess.
Okay, continue.
Funding of capital projects. We frequently get questions about how capital projects are funded because people understand, on the one hand, that funds are immediately available as soon as the bonding bills are enacted, but they know we don't run out right away and issue bonds. How that works is capital projects that come out of bonding proceeds are ultimately funded by bonds when we go to market for them. However, what we do is for immediate funding needs for projects that are enacted and we haven't yet gone to market with the bonds for those projects is that they're funded out of the general fund, and then the general fund is reimbursed once the bonds are issued. Another common misconception is that if we enact a $500 million bonding bill, MMB doesn't immediately run to market and sell $500 million worth of bonds. For one thing, that would have us be paying debt service on a whole lot of principal that isn't going to be spent right away. As you know, it can take 1, 2, 3, 4 years for projects to get off the ground and be fully constructed. So what MMB does, both for sound debt management and for IRS regulations relating to how many bond proceeds you have sitting out there that haven't yet been spent on projects, every time we get ready to go to market with a general obligation bond issue, we ask agencies to tell us what they estimate their capital project funding needs are going to be for the next year or so, which is the period of time that that bond issue is expected to cover capital appropriations. So, or funding, capital funding needs. So that way we're only going to market and issuing the number of bonds that we think will actually be able to spend the proceeds in the next year or year and a half or so. Cancellation of capital appropriations. The statute, Section 16A, has got a statute that provides that capital appropriations, whether they're out of bonding money or another source of funding, such as general fund cash, are canceled after 4 years. That's an incentive to both state agencies receiving capital funding and local government grantees to get those projects out the door. And how this works is that by statute, the Commissioner of Management and Budget is required to prepare and submit to the legislature every other year on January 1st of every odd number year a list of bond and general fund capital appropriations which were enacted more than 4 years prior to that January 1st date. And that report shows balances that have been neither spent nor are encumbered in our accounting system. What that means is funds that are spent, of course, have been spent. Funds that are encumbered, agencies have actually gone into the accounting system, and by encumbering the funds, they indicate that they have signed a contract for that money, so that money will become an obligation of the state, and so we do not cancel that. We only cancel fund balances that are neither spent nor encumbered. those funds are not automatically canceled on that January 1. They are not actually canceled until the following July 1 to give the legislature time to extend those appropriations if they would like to. I won't spend a lot of time on this slide. Capital budget and debt management works together on a number of ways. We collaborate in generating the numbers for debt service that we carry in our forecasts. We address bondability questions which arise in relating both to capital budget requests and to ongoing projects to make sure that funds are spent appropriately both under state law and IRS regulations. We work together on implementation issues. Sometimes we consult with the Attorney General's office and our bond counsel, and we produce a number of publications designed to help with compliance, and my colleague will also discuss this, but one of them is called After the Bonding Bill, which is a document that our agency produces after every large even year bonding bill. We also maintain a capital grants manual that both agencies and local governments find helpful in winding their way through the capital budget process. So that concludes my presentation.
Identify yourself for the tape and get started.
For the record, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget. And as Gay has indicated, I am going to talk about not only the state debt management practices, but just give an overview of bonding to the committee. First page, but the second slide just is a generic definition of what is a bond. I'm sure most of you are very familiar with this, but it's municipal bonds are debt securities that are issued by states, cities, counties, and other local governments to finance capital projects such as buildings, schools, highways, sewer systems, and also to fund day-to-day obligations. And in the case, the issuer, and that would be the state in this case, agrees to pay interest as well as the return on investment, the principal, to the bondholders who have lent the assure money for the project or projects. And oftentimes we refer to home mortgages as a nice analogy for kind of bonding in terms of if you have a longer home mortgage, you're going to pay a higher interest rate, but you're going to have lower payments. If you have a shorter home mortgage, you're going to pay lower rates, but your payments are going to be higher. But it's kind of a similar, you know, easy analogy when you're talking about bonds. Of course, bonds come with lots more rules. The next slide talks about the authority, and Gay has touched on this as well, is that the authorization determines the type of bonds that are issued. You know, we are driven by our state constitution, Minnesota statutes, 16A for our GO bonds, but for other authorities in the state that do have bonding authority, they have, you know, special legislation. There's language and statutes that gives them the authority to issue different types of bonds. And then, of course, Gay mentioned the federal regulations, the IRS being key, but also, you know, we have the SEC for continuing disclosure requirements and the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board that is also affecting regulations of municipal bonds. The next slide does show a list of all of the state bond issuers, most of them that you think about. Our bonds that are issued by MMB, those are our GO various purpose bonds, our trunk highway bonds, and then our certain revenue bonds, specifically the 911 revenue bonds that have been issued for the state's armor project. But you can see that there are other entities that do have bonding authority. It was raised, the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency does issue bonds. You can see the others on this list. Other types of state obligations that the state has is also, that's been mentioned in questions.
Yes, excuse me, Mr. Yes. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just, you know, wondering, when we issue revenue bonds and the revenue doesn't come in, I mean, what happens to our bond rating if revenue bonds don't make enough money to pay the revenue?
Well, the, you know,
they're kind of a quasi-state thing.
Ms.
Chairman, Representative, in terms of the revenue bonds that are dependent on the state revenues, the, you know, the bondholders are at risk for that. It will affect the bond ratings of those bonds, but not the state's bond issues. So the 911 revenue bonds that the state issued, they have their own bond ratings different than those of the state's GOs. So obviously those ratings would be clearly impacted if there was a default on those bonds.
Representative Rugavina, was that it?
Well, yeah, that's fine, Mr. Chair. I was just fine.
Representative Hausman.
And then just by contrast, it will be helpful for the committee to understand what happens if a revenue stream doesn't come in for that might be anticipated on an appropriation bond.
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Representative Hausman, for an appropriation bond, those are usually, if it's a state appropriation, it's backed by, you know, the legislature being willing to make that appropriation. And if the legislature were to non-appropriate or non-allocate that payment, those bonds would be in default. And those ratings are tied to the state's bond rating, and the rating agencies would definitely look unfavorable upon that.
And, Mr. Chair, the reason I mention that, my understanding is this discussion of the Viking Stadium, that that some people have advised that the revenue bond is not going to be an appropriate tool and that it will be an appropriation bond, but let's just say that the legislature determines that gambling is going to be the revenue stream. If sufficient gambling revenue doesn't come in, the general fund is obligated anyway.
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Representative Hausman, if it is, in fact, an appropriation bond, and the appropriation bonds that we currently have outstanding, whether it's with the University of Minnesota or the Housing Finance Agency, the legislature could, in fact, take action to not allocate for those payments. So that's not a pledge of the full faith and credit of the state to make those payments. The issue with an appropriation bond is that the bondholders are expecting that, you know, the issuer is going to make that annual appropriation, but should the revenues come up shy, there is the prerogative of the issuer, whether it's the state or a local government, to not appropriate funds to make those debt service payments.
Representative Hausman.
But in that case, unlike the revenue bond, where the bondholder is in default, with an appropriation bond.
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Representative, then the state would be in default.
The state is in default.
Well, Ms. Hansen, as long as we're on that subject, what are the interest rates on those kinds of bonds that were just discussed by Representative Rukavina and Hausman?
As you know, back in September, we sold the state's GO bonds, and we had a true interest cost rate of 2.82%. In this current market, if it were a GO, and 20 years the limit by the Constitution, those rates would be closer to 2% because interest rates are so low right now. Appropriation bonds would carry a bond rating that's just a notch below the state's bond ratings, and so they would get rates not as low as the GO bonds, but they would be still fairly low.
Continue. Yes.
There are other types of state obligations that we have. We have the state standing appropriations, which we talked about earlier, the University of Minnesota, both the biomedical science buildings, as well as the stadium, MHFA, and then the certificates of participation, which were used to fund the SWIFT project. We do have lease purchase financing for equipment. The state has a master lease program to finance equipment, computer equipment, and as well as vehicles. We do have lease purchase financing for real estate. The Freeman Building and the Anderson Building were funded with a lease purchase that was issued by the St. Paul Port Authority. And then there are two credit enhancement programs that are available to Minnesota school districts as well as cities and counties. And this program, this isn't an issuance of the state, but the state backs the payment on the bonds. Should the school district or county or city participating in the credit enhancement program not be able to make their debt payments, and these are on their GO bonds, so they're pledging their own taxing power, the state would step in and make those payments, but it's not money that we're just giving them. The state would then withhold state aids for them so that it's not free money. The next slide just shows the amount of debt currently outstanding on state obligations, and you'll see here that this includes the GO debt, which is various purpose and trunk highway, which is about $5.4 billion, the 911 revenue bonds, and a number of other revenue bonds that have been issued by the various authorities that's currently outstanding. There's a handful that we don't have the updated information, and this is actually as of yesterday, but I accidentally typed, 2/1/16, so I was projecting into the future. Most bond payments are made the first of the month, so it's pretty safe to say that those are the outstanding debt amounts at this point in time. And you can see most of the other bonds issued are revenue bonds. They're not a GO pledge to the state. And we've talked about different types of bonds already. The general obligation bond, which is backed by the full faith and credit by the state. These kind of bonds carry the lowest interest rates because of that full faith and credit backing. They are more secure to bondholders. And I talked also about revenue bonds, which are backed by a specific project or source of revenue. And back in December, I did present information, which I can share the handout with you. It was that joint hearing about financing for the stadium, but it talks about GO bonds, appropriation bonds, and revenue bonds, which is probably will be a nice source for you in terms of the bonding world. Obviously, Gay has touched on tax-exempt versus taxable bonds. That goes to kind of the use of the facilities and the revenue stream. There's fixed rate or variable rate bonds. Currently, the state does not issue variable rate bonds. We don't have that authority, but you will find that some of the other authorities do have the ability to issue variable rate debt. And then the length of the bond, long-term or short-term bonds, do exist. As I indicated, the state's GOs have to be 20 years in length, but there have been other issues that are longer and also shorter. The 9-1 bonds are shorter than 20 years. Gay talked in detail about the types of projects eligible for GO bond financing, so I'm not going to go through that slide again. And then this is some of the other purposes that GO bonds can be used for, and they're obviously used on a less frequently, but that is what is defined in the state's constitution. And then in addition, we talked about GO bonds. The state is pledging its full faith and credit, which is a guarantee to bondholders. And then also in state statute and the state constitution, should the state not be able to make its debt service payment, the state will levy a tax necessary to meet its debt service obligations. That's what a GO pledge is. Cities, counties, school districts all have this GO pledge. And this language, like I said, is included in state statute. It's also included in the state's constitution. What's also important to note, which bondholders like with the state of Minnesota debt, is we make a transfer from the general fund into the debt service fund by December 1st of each year. And that is a transfer for 19 months of the next payments. So it's more than a year, and bondholders look very favorably on that, as well as the rating agencies. Each bond issue must distinctly specify the purposes and maximum amount of proceeds authorized to be expended for such purposes. And if you've seen a copy of an official statement, they are on the MMB website. There are pages, single space, that show what all the authorizations are and the dollar amount. So you can see, yes?
Ms. Hansen, I have a question on the first bullet point. A full faith and credit obligation of the state. State will levy a tax if necessary to meet its debt service obligations. What tax may that be? What tax can that be? And who authorizes the tax?
Chairman, I'm going to read from the state's constitution.
I thought you might.
Subdivision 11, constitutional tax levy. Under the Constitution, Article 11, Section 7, the state auditor must levy each year on all taxable property within the state a tax sufficient with the amount then on hand in the state bond fund, and that's the state's debt service fund, to pay all principal and interest on state bonds due and to become due to and including July 1st in the second ensuing year. The tax is not subject to limitation of rate or amount. However, the amount of money appropriated from other sources as provided in Subdivision 10 and actually received in on hand prior to the levy in each year reduces the amount of the tax otherwise required to be levied. The proceeds of the tax must be credited to the state bond fund. So that is part of the state's constitution. And part of the reason we have that 19-month transfer is to allow for, if there isn't sufficient dollars in there, that tax levy would be able to get in place and the bondholders would be paid.
Okay, thank you very much.
And then a special and separate bond fund is set up, and that's for the debt service payment. In addition, there is a bond proceeds fund set up as well. Now the fun part, the capital investment guidelines. As you know, prior to 2009, the state had basically one guideline, and that was that our GO bond could not be more than 3% of the general fund revenues. In 2009, those were changed, and now we have three guidelines. And what was happening is that the rating agencies, the 3% of the general fund didn't mean anything to them. And so these tie out more closely to the analysis that the rating agencies look at. And so our first guideline is the total tax-supported principal outstanding, which means that bonds that have actually been issued, shall be 3.25% or less of the total state personal income. And as of the November forecast, which will change in several weeks, the total principal outstanding was $5.983 billion, of which 2.45 was of state personal income, which means that we have a remaining principal capacity of issued GO bonds, as well as other tax-supported debt of $1.96 billion. And it doesn't include just the GO bonds. It includes the state appropriations, the commitment that we've made to the University of Minnesota. It includes the commitment we've made to MHFA. And so it includes all debt that's supported, tax-supported debt, not just the GOs. And that's what the rating agencies look at. Guideline number two is the total amount of principal both issued and authorized unissued. And Gay mentioned that when we pass a bonding bill, we don't go out and issue the entire amount of the bond issue. We issue it over time depending on the cash flow needs for the projects. And so that's for state general obligations, state moral obligations, equipment leases, real estate capital leases shall not exceed 6% of the total state personal income. And as of November forecast, the total principal, both issued and authorized and unissued, was just over $8 billion, which is 4.02% of the state personal income. And some of the questions that are coming up are in regards to these two guidelines. What can we afford, and what about these other projects? As you know, the governor's proposal includes $775 million in GO bonding, but there's been discussion about a stadium, and depending on what type of bonds are issued for that, if there's a project, revenue bonds do not count against the debt management guidelines because they're supported not by the state. They're not tax-supported debt of the state. They are actually supported by a revenue stream. General obligation bonds or appropriation bonds would fall under guidelines 1 and 2. In addition, there's been the project raise of the capital renovation project, and those would be general obligations, so they would fall under guidelines 1 and 2.
Ms. Hansen, this is where I'm going to ask you the question I told you that I would ask you, but I'm going to rephrase it a little bit. Let's say we want to do the capital restoration, and we'll pick $250 million just to have an even number. And if we authorized in this year's bonding bill $50 million available July 1st, 2012, and then we had four separate clauses in that bonding bill, the first one would be July 1st, 2013 is when that $50 million would be enacted. Are you following me? then July 1st, 2014, that section of the bill would be enacted. So until then, they would not be in law. But if future legislative leaders didn't change that, they would become law. Would that then affect our debt capacity if they were not enacted?
Chairman, if they were not enacted in statute, they would not apply. However, for case of illustration, let's say this legislature passed $50 million for the capital renovation project. As I indicated before, we don't necessarily issue that $50 million all up front, and so whatever we issue, you know, with the GO bond issue would apply to guideline one, whatever percentage that is, and the total $50 million would apply to guideline two, because some of it would be issued and some would be authorized but unissued.
Well, Ms. Hanson, there are some members that would like to put forward all $250 million this year in a bonding bill. If that were the case, that would lower the debt capacity we'd have for, what I'd lack of a better term, the normal bonding bill, would it not? So if the governor's bill was in fact a bill we would pass, then it would, the governor I think is 755, then it would be 505. Are you following what I'm saying? But if we did it in the other fashion, then it wouldn't affect our debt capacity, correct?
Chairman, I see what you're saying. So that assuming that the entire project is included in the 775, it would have the kind of same effect now that we'd see in the February forecast, we wouldn't have it issued. We have a portion of it. Let's say it passes. You'd have a portion of it issued in guideline one that would qualify for that. And then if the full $775 million is authorized but not all issued, that would be in guideline two. But if it's an above that,
Ms. Hanson, if $200 million of it is not enacted into law,
it wouldn't be.
So the bonding bill might be $755 in reality, but $200 of it would be enacted years later. So it would. Representative Hausman, maybe you can answer it.
Well, I'm going to try this, because what under normal budgets, what you're describing would be an open and standing appropriation. And you don't have to enact it every year. You just assume that goes, that amount goes on. We've never done that in bonding, and I don't think we would be able to.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chairman, the legislature can only enact a law at this time. The legislature doesn't have authority to enact a law in another year without voting on it in that year. It seems to me what you're talking about is either a delayed effective date or a schedule for the project. So in other words, one option, which was done with the transportation bonding bill in 2008, all of that $1 billion plus of trunk highway bonds was authorized and appropriated in that bill that year, but there was included in the enactment a schedule saying this amount of the bond appropriation in this bill will be available in this biennium, another amount in the next biennium. So it had a schedule of when the bonds would be issued spelled out in the law, so that it wasn't all going to be done at once. It was over a period of 6 to 8 years, but the law itself and the appropriation was all in 1 year. It was enacted, because if you're not enacting a law, you're not doing anything. You're either enacting a law or you're not enacting a law. So it seems to me the option is a schedule, but you've already taken the action, and you're right, the legislature could come back and somehow affect that, change the appropriations, but depending on the stage of the project. But it would have to be enacted or not enacted.
But then, Ms. Dyson, being enacted, then that money would count as our debt capacity.
Yes, correct.
Okay, that answers a question a colleague wanted me to ask.
Chairman, I wanted to add that I thank
Ms. Dyson for bringing that up, because that was exactly the example that I was thinking of. And just to be clear, under that schedule, those amounts that are that have been enacted but they're not available until future years, all those amounts are considered authorized debt, so that would count against our guideline too. Even though they're not available until the mm-hmm. future, they count against that guideline now.
Okay.
The last guideline, guideline 3, just talks about how we structure our GO bonds and that we actually pay off principal earlier than the traditional level principal and interest payments. We actually schedule them as level principal, and it states that 40% of our state GO bonds are to mature within 5 years and 70% within 10 years. This is very conservative. Most issuers issue level P&I, and so this is looked upon favorably by the rating agencies and is more conservative than what other issuers do. Oops. We have additional informal debt policies and practices. As you heard, we are dictated by state regulations, the state constitution, and federal regulations. And so we have some informal debt policies and practices in place to help protect the state. Gay mentioned kind of the issue of the IRS. And in the last several years, the IRS has ramped up its office for tax-exempt bonds. They have, in 2010, they doubled the number of agents that are auditing tax-exempt bonds, and they have started doing questionnaires, examinations, audits, and things like that. They focused first questionnaires on nonprofits, then they looked at some of the bond issues that were allowable under federal regulations under the ARRA program. And so as a result, the state has developed a post-issuance compliance policy and procedures to kind of, you know, be in compliance with IRS regulations and kind of keeping track of what proceeds are being spent on, and to make sure that we are not in violation from a private use standpoint and any other issues. In this current interest rate environment, as you know, we have very low interest rates, as I mentioned. We do have refunding criteria that has been in place for decades, where if we were to do a refunding, we need to see at least a 5% present value savings on the issue, as well as 3% by maturity. These are guidelines that the GFOA recommends for issuers, and in my past life, this was kind of a recommendation to our clients in terms of doing a refunding. What was always important is that the issuer is receiving the savings and it's not benefiting the consultants. We also take a look at competitive versus negotiated sales. Because the state is a strong credit and we are not a frequent issuer, our bonds are very well received in the market, and people like to buy our bonds. But there was a case a couple of years ago where the credit market really tightened. It was hard to get access to the market. We needed to sell GO bonds for our bond proceeds, and we did a negotiated sale in order to access the capital market. So there's a time and a place for that, but our practice is to issue them competitively. Depending on the type of bond issue we have, we do use a financial advisor who is a fiduciary to the issuer, which is us, to help with monitoring the market, structuring bond issues to stay in compliance with our debt management guidelines. And then another issue is the timing of the bond sales, because I'm talking about we're in a very favorable interest rate environment. So issuers are refunding bonds right now. And there are certain times which may not be a good time to sell bonds just because of a disclosure standpoint. The SEC has this continuing disclosure requirement. Mm-hmm. We have an upcoming forecast coming out, and we don't want anything to happen that could affect the credit quality of our issue, obviously the legislature's in session, and so there's unknowns about what kind of decisions might be made that might affect the credit of the state's bonds. And so we're not always just, you know, kind of running out to market. We have to be taken to consideration different issues that are going on in the economy that might affect the bond issues.
Representative Swedzinski.
Mr. Chair, have we refinanced our bonds lately? I possibility of last year, but has there been any of that conversation or resale?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Representative, we continue to monitor our bonds for refunding opportunities. Our financial advisor does it for us, and it sometimes seems like the entire underwriting community, because they'd all like to work for the state of Minnesota. But we had scheduled to refund bonds in the fall this year, and there were a couple things that were that resulted in us not doing that. Because of IRS regulations and the interest rates were so low, the premium was going to be too high, and there becomes IRS tax implications because of that, and so we have to be continually monitoring things like that. And so we pulled it for that purpose. And then also, the negative arbitrage was so high, and positive arbitrage is basically making money on borrowed money. IRS doesn't like you to do that, but there's also what's called negative arbitrage, which means that we can borrow at a low interest rate, but the investment rates for the escrow are so low that we actually have to issue more bonds to make that escrow sufficient enough to be able to pay off the old bonds at the time of the call date. And so there's, unfortunately, it's not black and white like a home mortgage where you can say, oh, interest rates are low, we're going to refinance. There's tax implications and other factors that we have to consider so we don't affect the tax exempt status of the bonds. But yes, we monitor it regularly. In fact, I just talked to our financial advisor a couple days ago about this and kind of the timing with the forecast, and should we do it during the legislative session and what that might mean.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hanson, I want to go back to the previous slide before we move to the next page, the capital investment guidelines. Guideline 1, Guideline 2 show that we have additional capacity available. It's not clear on Guideline 3. In fact, it would look, as on the surface, it looks as if you really don't have capacity unless there are bonds that are expiring in July or in the last half of this year, because the percentages are right now right at the guidelines. So what is the additional capacity that's available with Guideline 3?
The issue for Guideline, Chairman, Representative, Guideline 3 has to do with how we structure the bond, so there's not necessarily a capacity piece to that. So what we do is when we bring our GO bonds to market, we, if it looks, like we're going to kind of not meet the thresholds where 40% of our state GO principal is paid off within 5 years and 70% matures within 10 years, we actually will structure the next issue and move principal forward in order to be in compliance with this. And you'll note that the estimates for June 30th in 2011 were, that actually should be 2013, they're actually lower, and the reason is that the proceeds from the tobacco securitization bonds were used to refund some earlier maturities of the state's GO bonds, and so that's why it's lower. So it's not necessarily a capacity, it looks to how we structure the bonds and how quickly we pay off the principal.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But there must be, I understand what you're saying, but there must be a point at which the guideline would be violated. And how and when do you determine that?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Representative, we recalculated every forecast.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But as we pass a bill, we have to have some sense as to whether we, by passing a particular bill, whether or not we're going to stay within this Guideline 3. So are you able to advise us and tell us what that number might be?
Ms. Hanson.
Chairman, Representative Lanning, depending on the size of the bond issue that passes, if there's a bonding bill, and Gay had indicated that we don't issue it all at once, when we know how much money we need for that bonding bill, this is a calculation that's very easy to do, kind of the percent that's paid off. And so we would structure the bonds to stay in compliance. We would move the principal forward to do so. And we did that for the 2011 bond sale. We moved the principal up early to stay within those. And we also inform the rating agencies of this as well.
Okay. Ms. Hanson, I was hoping that Representative Banyan would ask you this question, but I'm going to ask you, well, go ahead, Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the invitation. Am I correct in saying then that in essence, guideline 3 is a guideline for you in terms of the maturity spectrum that you issue to, and it's not really a bind on the total level, because they can just restructure the bond portfolio they hold to meet guideline 3. It's only guidelines 1 and 2 that sort of set a cap on the total amount of indebtedness we can have. Did I represent that right?
Ms. Hansen?
Chairman, Representative, you exactly.
Representative Banyan, that wasn't the question I wanted to ask.
I'm as good economist, but a lousy mind reader.
Representative Drazkowski, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if you'd review for us how we I do remember some changes to these guidelines a year or two ago. Could you review that for us and review what the guidelines were before and how we got to where we are here?
Ms. Hansen.
Chairman, Representative, back in 2009, the guidelines were changed, and that was obviously before my tenure. But what was going on is at that time there was one guideline. It was 3% of the general fund revenues was the amount of bonds outstanding, and it did not take into consideration any of the other kind of tax-supported debt that the state held, which would be the appropriation bonds of the University of Minnesota, the Housing Finance Agency, and other debt that was supported above and beyond the GO bonds. So it just focused on the GO bonds. And so, and I had indicated earlier that it was not a guideline that the rating agencies looked at. It did not tie out to some of the factors that the rating agencies looked at when analyzing credits. And so the new guidelines are more closely aligned with how the rating agencies look at credits and, you know, their debt issuance and their policies and things like that. So I understand that it took a while to develop those policies before they were enacted or adopted in 2009.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I'm just curious. So, where did the new guidelines come from, and how were those designed at the time? It seems that these are guidelines that were imposed originally on the legislature, on this committee. If I recall, we were bumping up against that 3% limit, and suddenly the appetite for borrowing and spending more was greater than the box we lived within, and it just appears that we created a new set of guidelines for ourselves. I'm curious, how were these constructed? Who constructed them? That type of thing.
Ms. Hansen, for Representative Drazkowski, if you'd like to know how the 3% came about, you talk to Representative Anzalk, and he will tell you exactly where they came from. Representative Hausman.
That guideline, 3% of the general fund, one of the reasons that Governor Pawlenty began to look for other guidelines is it didn't allow a comparison from state to state, because the general fund varies vastly from state to state. So it's like comparing apples and oranges. So Governor Pawlenty determined that really wasn't a terribly helpful one, and Governor Pawlenty devised new guidelines. They are not adopted, and there's a reason for that. Because someone in the distant past probably assumed, should the state ever inadvertently offend those guidelines, they'd be in violation of the law if we put these in the law. The advice about guidelines was they should stay just that. They should be guidelines to the legislature. And, in fact, we have always taken them seriously. But so Governor Pawlenty said it makes more sense to look at personal income, because you can compare that state to state. It makes more sense to look at total debt, because you can compare that broadly. And so it was a practical decision made by Governor Pawlenty, but is only a governor's guideline and nothing more than that, not adopted by the legislature.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is a follow-up for Representative Hausman or others. But at the same time, if I remember correctly, we were bumping up against what was then the operating procedure, which was a 3% guideline, and whether it was coincidental that we considered these new guidelines that seem to be supported by the rating agencies, or at least somehow indexed by them. I think the political reality, if I remember correctly, was we wanted, not all of us, but the legislature at the time or the governor together wanted to borrow more money than that guideline at the time provided for. Is that did I remember correctly?
My guess is that Ms. Dyson may have it. My sense is we have always stayed, we've always taken the guidelines seriously, and we've always stayed roughly within the guidelines. Because the general fund was this awkward number, 3% of the general fund can vary dramatically. It became, particularly in a period of downsizing, a more awkward guideline for us to measure, and Ms. Dyson looks like she has a little more information.
Ms. Dyson?
The only thing I wanted to add to what Representative Hausman has described is that the 3% guideline that you're referring to and bumping up against it, actually without having issued any additional debt, that because of the economic conditions in the state, the 3% had already been gone past, so that without issuing debt, without authorizing any debt, the state was already over the 3% guideline when at the time the legislature had last acted, it was below it. So it was a change in economic conditions and the state general fund. And the advice from MMB, they worked on the guidelines for well over a year before they changed their policy, but the 3% had already been busted without the legislature doing anything.
Representative
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kuskowski, you go first, and then I'll...
Thank you. Well, thank you, Ms. Dyson. That does refresh my memory. So, indeed, what we did is the guideline had been exceeded by the conditions that were in front of us, and we didn't follow it. And that seems to be what happened, and so it appears we created some new guidelines that provided for more space, and a refresh of history is helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think the just Representative Roskowski, I think the new guidelines just made more sense. They were created with much more information and thoughtfulness than the 3%. Representative Kahn.
Well, I just wanted to put my faulty memory on 3%. I actually think that was a number that was picked out of thin air and had no bearing really on anything, and it was just
an airport. Perfect.
Yes, I was going to say that. And there were many other, there were several other criteria that could have been used. You know, people felt it was good to have some limit. Mm-hmm. But another question I'd like to ask is, I've never understood why it made any difference how much the legislature had appropriated in bonding bills, and that what really only mattered was the amount of bonds that had been let. And you could have bonds that were, and I never understood why the amount of bonds that weren't being used would have any effect on the credit rating of the state, because you can't just use them. There's got to be, you know, a government decision to do that. So I'm sorry if this was answered before, but that's my question.
Is that a question to
yes,
me?
Yes, it's a question.
This answer?
Yeah.
Maybe
whatever.
Representative
or
Kahn,
anybody who can answer it. Why does it matter?
Repeat the question.
Why isn't the only thing that matters the amount of bonded debt that we had that we have that's been issued, rather than bonds that have been listed in a bonding bill?
Chairman,
Ms.
Hansen. Representative. That's just one factor that the rating agencies look at. There is multiple factors that rating agencies look at for any kind of credit. They look at, you know, debt that's outstanding. You know, in this case, you know, with the state, we have a fair amount of debt that's authorized and unissued, so that we know that that's a future commitment. They look at debt structure. Those get written up in rating agency reports. But they also look at things, you know, the economy, of which we have no control over. They look at management, financial management practices. So this is just one piece, and what we're seeing now is actually an increased, you know, pension liabilities are included in their analysis and things like that. So it's a much more thorough analysis than just the outstanding debt.
Well, I was interested in going the appropriated debt, but that hasn't been, the bonds haven't been sold for it yet. Why does that have any effect on anything?
Ms. Hansen. Chairwoman, Representative, because that's a future commitment that the state is making.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is why is it a commitment until the state puts the bonds on the market and sells the bonds for the
Ms. Hansen. Chairman, Representative, it's one factor that the rating agencies, it's one, they look at it. Not only are they looking about how much debt we have outstanding, but they see that, you know, the state has made a future commitment to issue more debt, and that gets calculated into kind of our debt burden, which is a factor that they look at from a rating agency standpoint.
Follow up?
No.
Okay. Madam Chair. Representative Raskowski.
Thank you. Real quickly, Madam Chair, just wanted to know, do we know what our total debt is? We mentioned about $6 billion in GO debt. Do we know what our revenue bond debt is? And if you add them all up, how much in debt is the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Hansen, Chairwoman, Representative, we have that list on that one slide. The outstanding GO debt is just under $5.5 billion right now, and then we have the list of the other, not necessarily state-issued, but by the different authorities, because some of them haven't been updated, you know, but we could add that all together and come up with what's outstanding. But also remember, a lot of those are revenue bonds, which are supported by a separate revenue stream. And they're not coming out of the general fund of the state.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to correct an impression that may have been given by Representative Draskowski's question. The Pawlenty administration did not recommend these guidelines so that they could spend more money. In fact, all you have to do is ask all the people who had their projects vetoed by the governor. And a pretty long, significant list. And so that was not the reason. I think as Representative Hausman pointed out, and as the chair pointed out, this made sense to make this change in order to give us a better comparison with other states.
Thanks for that clarification. Anybody else? Go ahead and proceed.
A few more slides. Okay. Bond ratings, we've obviously talked about that and what the rating agencies look at. As you're probably familiar, bonds may be rated by one or more of the three major credit rating agencies. Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Our GO bonds are rated by all three. And obviously, a bond rating is a measure of a credit risk to investors. The higher the bond rating, the lower the interest rate, the lower the risk to the investors, the lower bond rating, the higher the risk, the higher the interest rate. Our current bond ratings with the three rating agencies, Fitch has a AA+, AA1, and S&P a AA+, and then the 911 revenue bonds, which the rating is based on the revenue stream and the coverage, a Fitch AA, Moody's AA3, and an S&P AA+. Just in context, there are nine states currently that have a pure AAA rating, which is AAAs from all three of the rating agencies. There are six states that have two AAAs and then a AA rating. There are three that are not doing very well at all. They have less than a AA3 or a AA. Those would be California, Illinois, and D.C., and Puerto Rico also falls in that, but no, they're not a state. So we're actually kind of in the middle with the rest of the states. We've alluded, Gay and I have both alluded to this through our presentations. Obviously, with the IRS and the tax kind of code change of 1986 and some of the more recent activities, you know, we have to continue to make sure that our bonds remain tax exempt that have been issued, and that, you know, you've heard that they've ramped up their efforts to take a look at tax-exempt issuers. Arbitrage is a factor. There's rules involving that. We make sure we meet the 18-month spend down. There's, you know, exemptions. We file not only an annual disclosure on all of our bond issues, which is an SEC rule 15C212 that was put in place in 1995, but we also do voluntary disclosures, and we do material event notices. In the case where our bond rating was downgraded, we did need to notify the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, and that information gets disseminated to the bondholders, and then just kind of that increased enforcement that the IRS has. So those are things that, you know, we're doing for the state as the state's fiduciary for the bond issues. There's a lot of details that we need to continue to monitor.
Very good. Members, any questions? Representative Bills.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hansen, you know, I was on, as you get into the guidelines, I was surfing around deed and everything, trying to figure out, you know, just the specifics under, in terms of calculating personal income. And I was wondering if you had any place where I could go to try to find, you know, kind of a line item, how is personal income built up when deed does it, and is it exposed to any federal expenditures or transfer payments or things like that? So I didn't know if you could help. So thank you.
Chair, Representative, for the case of the forecasts and the calculations of the debt capacity guidelines and where we're at any given point in time, we actually get numbers. The state economist gets numbers for us, so we're not, I do not believe that we're getting them from deed. There's numbers that are being compiled by the state economists, and they have resources that they use.
Representative Bills.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So that would be the state economist, or what does Global Insight also, does Global Insight calculate those numbers? Okay, thank you. Hansen.
Chair, Representative, I do believe that's the source, but I do want to confirm that for you.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions, folks? Representative Bannion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you've inspired a second question, Representative Bills, then. We only use data of personal income as it actually exists. Are we using forecast numbers to do a forecast for where we're meeting these numbers in the future, or are we just, or we only, because that would be what Global Insights would provide. Otherwise, state personal income is data created by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, I believe. Federal Bureau.
Chair, Representative, I would have to verify that for you. And okay. You know, we'll get that. But no, that's a good question and a good information to know.
Representative Bannion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Hansen. I have a second question related to the debt service report the debt capacity report, excuse me, that we have in front of us, and it's got debt service cost on here. And without wanting to reopen the longer discussion we had about guidelines and so on, we don't have any references to debt service as a share of anything like the general fund or something like that. That's not a guideline. But I would just note with some surprise, if you read the forecast, when you go to 2014, we go from GO debt service of 409 in forecast 2013 to 808 in forecast of 2014. That's a pretty large jump. I'm not sure I understand how that happens. Could you explain that to us?
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, there's a couple of things that are going into play here. First of all, and Representatives referring to page 3 of the debt capacity forecast, which I do believe you have a copy. And if you look at the GO bonds, the subtotal, and you can see this is debt service costs. This is not annual debt service payments. This is actually the money that gets transferred from the state's general fund to the debt service fund. And you can see in 2012 and 2013, those numbers are low. There's two factors that are contributing to that. Because the interest rate market is so low, when we sell our bonds, we get what's called a premium. It's like reverse of points on a mortgage. When you, yep, you know, pay points, you get lower interest rates. Well, if you get a premium, you know, there's higher interest rates. And our bonds traditionally sell a lot with a lot of 5% coupons. It looks good to the investors. And so we get a large premium. And that money, by state law, needs to go into that debt service fund. And so it reduces the cost. And then the other factor for 2012 and 13 is that when we sold the tobacco securitization bonds, the bond proceeds at $640 million went to refund maturities on the state's GOs to reduce the debt service transfer. And so that's why it's a lower number as well. So those two factors are coming into play there. And that's why it'll go back up. And depending on forecast numbers, depending on where interest rates are, those numbers could be lower in the future, depending if we're getting premiums.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. It's very thorough. And so we should view the lower debt service in 2012-2013 as a momentary phenomenon, not and just an interruption of a trend that was rising throughout the latter part of the 2000s.
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And you know, a couple years out, depending on where the interest rate market is, we could see high premiums still that would reduce that. But we
Representative Ann.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then that I'm not aware does Global Insight this is a debt service. This is based on bonds you've actually issued with coupons that already exist. This is not a statement of a forecast of where interest rates will be in 2014, correct?
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, I do believe that it does include forecasts of interest rates because we do get that from Global Insights when they're doing the forecast, and those get incorporated into the debt service payments.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then can you provide us with information on what you expect those interest rates to be, please?
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, I will not have that information until the end of February like you. Or the February forecast.
Well,
but then those numbers will be available.
But well, Madam Chair, yes. Ms. Hansen, you do have the information from the November forecast.
I do. Would have to, okay. Chair, Hansen, Representative. Yes, those numbers. Yes, right. We would be able to get those for the November forecast, but for the upcoming forecast, I'm not privy to that information.
Well, I try.
Representative Bills.
Oh, thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Ms. Hansen, does that then, I still have my sheet from last year, sorry,
that you brought,
and I made notes on, and then that would explain, as I was looking at this a little bit earlier then, I was wondering why, if you go back up that column, then you look at the one that you gave last year, and it was 2011, 447, then 670, 709, and that's turned into, you know, from 670 to 263. So that's that one-time anomaly that you're referring to.
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, you are correct.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. No,
and you'll note that for 2011, we actually have an actual now, which is slightly less than that 447 you mentioned.
Yep. Yes. Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And without retilling old ground with Representative Lanning down there, but looking at another indicator, members, and Ms. Hansen, maybe you can validate this. I know these numbers are, as you mentioned, dollars that are put into the bond proceeds account, or the bond, I don't remember what the name of the account is, but I would expect they correlate pretty closely with our total debt service in the biennium. As we look at 2006 and 7, it looks like about $900 million between those 2 years. And 10 years later, 16 and 17, we're looking at $1.9 billion. Is that pretty close to what we would project for debt service as you look at the combination of those two numbers?
Ms. Hansen. Chair, Representative, those numbers take into consideration the interest rates provided by Global Insights, and as you know, Gay kind of alluded to, we have that rolling average for our bond issues, and you may have recalled that on an off number year, that number used to be 140, and now that's gone up to 225, and the 775 has gone to a lower number, and it's based on those kind of looking at the every other year rolling average, and as the bonding bills get larger, then the estimated debt service payments do so likewise.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hansen. members, again, just looking at the trends here, it's pretty alarming. As far as I can tell, at least the general direction seems to be one of at least doubling in 10 years' time what appears to be money going to pay off debt in one form or another. 100 or 110 or 120% growth in 10 years. That's pretty alarming as we look at the cost of the budget and taxpayers of Minnesota that are being brought forward by what seems to be a severe growth in borrowing on behalf of the state.
Anyone else? Representative Hausman.
Well, Madam Chair, I look at these and see something very different. If you compare the year 2006 to the year 2012 and even 2013, we're just about even or slightly below. What 14 to 17, and this is where I think you perhaps haven't quite helped us understand that. You're saying you've projected an interest rate, but you have not projected premiums. And we see how dramatically premiums changed that number in 2012. So I would almost suggest that those numbers for 14 to 17 really are very tenuous numbers.
Ms. Hanson.
Because they do not take into consideration the premium.
Ms. Hanson. Chair, Representative, at this point in time, they don't take into consideration the premium because that is dependent on the kind of forecasted interest rates. And if those forecasted interest rates are higher, then there'll be less premium. And so there is a relationship with kind of the interest rate assumptions going forward, as well as an estimate to what a premium might be. So these numbers are forecasted.
So, Madam Chair and members, I would just suggest we look at 2006 and look at 2013 and find that we have been very, very consistent over time with our debt.
Any other questions or comments, members? Okay. With that, meeting is adjourned.